Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. A prominent Canadian filmmaker stepped down as director of a new Indigenous TV series and had her documentary pulled from the Sundance Film Festival after questions arose about her claims of Indigenous identity. It's the latest in a long history of people leveraging questionable Indigenous heritage to get ahead and then having to withdraw when the facts about their identity surface. We'll talk more about it right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation has administered 98% of its current COVID-19 vaccine doses as the tribe receives additional vaccines and personnel this week to help administer more. As of Tuesday, the Navajo Area Indian Health Service had vaccinated more than 77,000 people from its supply of 78,520 vaccines. The Navajo Nation is set to receive more than 28,900 additional doses and clinical staff to help with vaccinations. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez talked about the tribe's vaccination plan during a virtual town hall Tuesday.
Our goal, ladies and gentlemen, is to give 100,000 shots to our Navajo people by the end of February. February is a short month, 28 days, and that's our goal for this month.
More than 170,000 Navajo citizens reside on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. Healthcare officials say Navajo citizens who live off the reservation are getting vaccinated when they return to their home communities. The Navajo Nation's additional support is in part due to hundreds of millions of federal dollars recently allocated to the Indian Health Service to assist with COVID-19 testing and vaccination efforts across Indian country. A Native American legislator in Wyoming says Congresswoman Deb Haaland has broad support among Indigenous people in her state to lead the Department of the Interior, as a number of U.S. Republican lawmakers are publicly opposing Haaland's nomination, concerned about resource development, citing Haaland's support of environmental policies. Representative Andy Clifford, Northern Arapaho, says if U.S. Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming opposes Haaland's nomination with a no vote, that would damage his relationship with Indigenous constituents.
You know, her nomination brings attention to the fact that she, as one of the first Indigenous female U.S. representatives, faces systemic racism, you know. And our Senator Barrasso, he has to do a better job of ensuring that everyone has the opportunity to participate in our democracy.
People across Indian country have expressed their excitement about the possibility of having a Native American as Secretary of the Interior.
What I see is happening is that more Indigenous people are becoming engaged and participating in processes that we've never been welcomed to participate in the past. And to me, that'll always be a step in the right direction. So when we're getting more diverse representation at the table, people get uncomfortable with that.
Barrasso has indicated he may vote against Haaland's confirmation, while Montana Senator Steve Daines has announced his intention to block her confirmation. Both Republican senators sit on the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, which will take up the confirmation.
We run for our sisters!
The Standing Rock Youth Council hosted a run Tuesday to urge President Biden to shut down the Dakota Access Pipeline. They posted updates throughout the day on social media. Lakota youth journeyed 93 miles to the site of the No Dapl resistance camps 4 years ago along the Cannonball River in North Dakota. People across the country showed their support to the youth by running in solidarity, sharing photos and videos on social media. Oil pipeline opponents are hopeful after Biden halted the Keystone XL pipeline. Opponents fighting a pipeline replacement project in Minnesota are urging the administration to stop construction of Line 3. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing scholarships to Native students of every age for over 30 years. Applications for the upcoming school year accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homeland, so share with Dewey via Skype. A conversation about a person's Native identity can sometimes be controversial. One person's definition might vary from someone else's. Even tribes have different methods of determining who is a member. The issue recently came back into the spotlight when the CBC news source looked into the Indigenous heritage claimed by filmmaker Michelle Latimer. Afterwards, she resigned as director of an Indigenous TV show she co-created. And Canada's National Film Board pulled her documentary film from the Sundance Film Festival. It sparked another conversation about Indigenous identity, or at least about people building a career on Native heritage that doesn't hold up. We invite you to join our conversation today. We hope you'll share how acts like this affect your Native life and what can be done about people who leverage false or inaccurate claims of Indigenous heritage. Give us a call. Join the conversation at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And today we are going to start off in the Bay Area in California. With us on the line is Dr. Andrew Jolivet, and he is a professor and department chair of ethnic studies and director of Native American and Indigenous Studies at the University of California, San Diego. He is also the board president of the American Indian Cultural Center in San Francisco, and he is from the Ishok Nation. Our pleasure to have him here on the line. Dr. Jolivet, welcome. And I know you go by Andrew. So, Andrew, thank you for being with us today. Welcome.
You're always Hokisaku's relatives. I want to introduce myself in the proper way. Andrew Jolivet from the Tisikeep clan of the Sunrise people of the Ishok Nation of Southwest Louisiana and Southeast Texas. I'm the son of Annetta and Kenneth and the grandson of Isabella Americus and Andrew and Gertie and Howard, the great-grandson of Lilla and Curtis, Eva and Edward, Rosina and Francois, and Allie and Eli. I want to recognize the Ohlone peoples of the territory from where I speak to you today. As a cultural protocol, I spoke with members of my tribe to receive their counsel to be with you here today. And I want to begin by praying for the family of the Honorable Judge Claudette White, one of our relations who just passed away this last week due to COVID, who served her community and all of Indian Country tirelessly as a tribal court judge. May her son and family be blessed with love, support, and community during this time. May we also pray for all those suffering great loss at this time, hurting due to this violent pandemic and ongoing colonial violence. I just wanted to provide a little context, too, and frame it up. You know, these are difficult conversations. And a friend actually wrote to me this morning, a relative, Chamorro relative, and she shared this poem by Craig Santos Perez. It's just a short excerpt for it. And it says, "When the tide of silence rises, say ocean. Then with the paddle of your tongue, rearrange the letters to form canoe." And it says, "Let's paddle together in the canoe toward, together in the canoe, riding the waves, listening to the wind, and reading the stars, kinship, medicine, and love guidance." So these conversations, I come from a place of cultural humility when I think about these questions. And the first thing I would say just, you know, about the conversation today is that we begin with cultural protocols, that we ask permission, you know, both with this case with the filmmaker in Canada who clearly had no connection to the community that she claimed. And I think we have to, you know, not just expose, but have repercussions for those who knowingly perpetuate fraud. And then I think we also have to begin, as I said, with this place of cultural humility and let that really guide us. Because when we go to somebody's house, you don't tell them how to arrange their furniture or what food to put in their refrigerator. So why would you tell a tribe or a nation that you're not a member of how to identify their members or to identify yourself as a member of their tribe without their permission? So I think this really lacks, you know, both cultural humility and an understanding of cultural protocols, not to mention, you know, a lack of ethics. And so the situation up there is really hard. We have the Arts and Craft Act here, for example, in the States to kind of guard against this, but we know that fraud continues to happen anyway, right? And so I hope today we'll talk about, you know, some possible solutions to address some of these things.
Sure. You know, and these kind of discussions become really important, especially when it comes to how it affects our tribal nations. And for you, Andrew, more to what is going on in Canada and what it's revealed about identity. A lot of people's critique is that this identity is something that is gaining her, you know, profit in her career. And so when we take a look at some of the reasons why some of these things come about, I think we get it to, you know, really important things of, you know, how it can affect our communities. And your understanding of when somebody falsely claims Indigenous heritage, identity, membership, what do you feel is the true insult, or what kind of mark is it really making in terms of the people who are legitimately members, who have heritage? Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, obviously, I mean, I think it's an act of violence, to be quite honest. I mean, if we look at the history of, you know, attempts at an Indigenous erasure, whether that's, you know, in Canada or, you know, the U.S. or throughout the Americas, for that matter. And so it really is an act of violence that, you know, for years, right, no, you know, people taking away our rights to identify, tribes being terminated, you know, tribes fighting to be, you know, recognized to, you know, live in their own territories without being bothered by outsiders. And so for folks, it kind of reminds me of conversations around religious, you know, appropriation too, where, you know, we had to pass the American Indian Religious Freedom Act just to get, you know, to be able to, you know, practice, you know, religion, faith, you know, traditions freely without outsiders. And to me, you know, it's this very paternalistic kind of thing of like, we get to tell you who you are, you know, we get, whether we recognize you or not, we get to tell you whether you can practice this religion or not. And then up comes some person who's complicit in that system, who actually is, you know, they've done it spiritually, right? Where, you know, they take on sort of these practices. Like, to me, it's very paternalistic. It's egregious, and it's wrong. And I think that, you know, the film industry, it needs to respond to it. I mean, I think sometimes it's like, why is it always, it's not just the responsibility of like Native folks to respond to this, right? I think it's actually these non-Native industries, you know, whatever they, you know, whether it's film or other areas, that also need to have major responsibility in making sure that when they claim they're centering Native and Indigenous people, that they actually are doing that. And I think it becomes more clear when people have those kind of relationships with their communities or not.
And, you know, the film industry, we bring our attention to that. The film industry, a lot of times, there are questionable things that happen in terms of identity. And, you know, we all know that Hollywood, the film industry, often sets the pace for people's understanding of many different things. And specifically to our Native nations, a lot of misconceptions come from by what is being portrayed in the film industry. And so that really is something that, of course, is on many people's radars, many discussions that we've had on this program. But when we get to this point, again, I want to know from you, our listeners, what do you think? What kind of effect does it have back to your home community, to your sense of identity, to your children's sense of identity? Go ahead and give us a ring, 1-800-996-2848. And Andrew, I don't know, I think I heard you had a little bit more to add. Go ahead.
You know, no, just as I'm listening to you, I think, you know, it also makes me think about just more directly or personally. I know when it's my tribe or my community, I come from a mixed race background, you know, and it also is the way that people then represent you, that's painful, that when people caricature, you know, it's that also, I think, is the impact, is that it's playing Indian, right? Quite literally, not just dressing up like we talk about Halloween or mascots, but this is literally taking over, you know, our lives and pretending to be us. And so I think that is a major issue that has consequences ranging from mental health issues to, you know, depression, anger, economic, you know, issues where it's very difficult. I work in academia. There's a small percentage of Native, you know, faculty, and we know that there are people who have been identified who are working in academia who are not who they say they are and knowingly continue to do these things. So I think we'll talk probably a little bit more about, you know, how we can address some of this stuff a little bit later in the show. But I think those are some of the issues that come to mind for me right now.
All right. Thank you for that. Let's go ahead and take a call. On the line, we have Phyllis in Standing Rock, North Dakota, tuned in on KLND. Phyllis, thanks for reaching out. Go ahead. You're on air.
Chante wish day nape to use up. I extend my heart with my hand with a good heart. Calling from Ochete Shakoi, and we had a great awakening, a great new threshold for acknowledgement of humanity. And so it was very difficult to see how many people came here to declare their indigenous physical makeup, their spirit, primarily their spirit, and it was beautiful. So we acknowledged, we did the declaration on Ochete Shakoi, and we defied the doctrine of discovery. And that's where the five papal bulls from the Vatican crossed into the Constitution, violating the Constitution and creating 11 Supreme Court cases that define Indian country. For us, Major Crimes Act was imposed because of Crow Dog versus Spotted Tail, which was a human trafficking case. And it created Indian law nationwide. So that's the one case, one of the 11, that we are redefining ourselves. We defied those. And so for us in Lakota, in Sioux Nation, as the treaty is with Lakota, Dakota, Nakota, making up 14 communities in the United States and 8 communities in Canada. That's who we are. So,
and you know what, with that introduction, you know what? I know there is something really important you're about to share with us, Phyllis. I'm sorry, we got to go to break here. Hang tight. I'll have you pick up right after the break. Again, if you want to join us, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to your call.
Bryden Gwiss grew up on the powwow trail. Now the Canadian dancer and musician is blending traditional powwow beats with hip-hop and other contemporary rhythms like this. Tune in to hear Bryden Gwiss, our January music maker, on the next Native America Calling.
Native Americans affected by domestic violence can call the Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources. Strong Hearts takes calls from those experiencing domestic violence, concerned family members and friends, and those with questions about what a healthy relationship looks like. Safe, anonymous, and confidential at 844-7-NATIVE. That's 844-7-NATIVE. This program supported by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Thanks for joining us today here on Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and we are talking about Indigenous identity. If you'd like to join us, phone lines are open now, 1-800-996-2848. We go back to our caller, Phyllis, who is joining us out of Standing Rock, North Dakota, tuned in on KLND. Phyllis, go ahead. I turn it back to you. Go ahead. Finish your thoughts.
Thank you. The doctrine of discovery defined us from day one from the Vatican, crossing barriers and creating illegal status for us. It applied to Asia, Africa, and the Americas. And so, you know, we, as my work in the UN for 20 years, from 1977 to 1998, initiating the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and that was identity to be defined. In the UN, the customary law box is empty, and we are trying to fill that now. We have been for 20 years to define ourselves. So we have many, many different levels and cases. As a co-founder of Women All Red Nations in 1978, we marched in 1972 in the Trail of Broken Treaties, and that was our right to our religious freedom, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, which is going on 41 years. We're just now at full adulthood on who we are and defining our own cultural values and identification for ourselves. Because when we have 33 treaties, the Lakota, with the United States, more than any other group. And so our lands have been invaded, taken, stolen, pilfered, and our identity as well. And the military rule has created, you know, children that were born out of rape. A lot of our children we kept. We were silent. That was a silent code, but our grandmothers kept those children. A lot of the women fled to the communities in Canada. So when Jacob Stevens wrote the treaty in 1805 at Port Sandusky, Ohio, for the Dakotas, he defined us as animals. So that was the first time the definition was put into context for writing, making it literal. So we were defined as two-thirds human being and one-third animal. So we're contesting the appropriations and demanding reparations on the definitions, carrying into appropriations that have only been 40% because we're part animal. We went to Geneva in 1977 saying we are the red race of the Western Hemisphere. We had to define ourselves, and we had to demand that the international community accept us as human beings. So it's been a life struggle. So I'm defending primarily my sister Madonna Thunderhawk, who co-founded the Women of All Red Nations, so we could follow our spirituality. We marched in the Trail of Broken Treaties thanks to the author Hank Adams, Mitakiase. He wrote those and helped to define the parameters for all the laws that embrace indigenous people. We coined the phrase indigenous in Geneva to encompass and include all of the natural peoples of the world. I didn't know. I went there thinking everybody was a Lakota. No, everybody's Indian. No, not everybody's Indian. They were natural people from all over the world. And so they clearly had their own definitions of who they were and their identity. But we thought it was a beautiful thing. And then fast forward to Ocheche Shakoi.
I got to jump in here because you really brought forward when we think of identity. And sometimes, you know, when we get into this conversation, a lot of times I think of we get into this conversation because of what is written on paper. And then we also, you know, got to bring in how we define ourselves in our home communities of where identity starts. And for many Indigenous people, that identity starts before you even arrive here, that all of those roads that are connected to you, all those ancestors who have made a pathway and are excited to see you start on your own path on, you know, this ground, Mother Earth. And thinking about that identity, and a lot of people, and I've heard it too, say how we identify, how we know ourselves as Native people supersedes anything that can ever be written on paper. And I think that also plays into this conversation too. A lot of times, you know, when it comes to identity and what the federal government says is true identity, sometimes how it's juxtaposed to how we know ourselves as Indigenous people, who we're born from, who our ancestors are, then things sometimes are seen in a different way. And Phyllis, I do got to get to some more guests who are on the line waiting to go, but I do want to get your thought. When it comes down to the basic roots of what is an Indigenous person, who is a Native person, who is Lakota, where does that go for? A lot of us look to our clans. A lot of us look to how we are named. But for you, What is that basic understanding of who truly is a Native person, who truly is Lakota? Phyllis, anything for me?
We have to define ourselves from our community. There are many, many components. Historically, those who lived among us, those who we adopted. One of the things we marched for, Standing Rock was one of the founding tribes of the Indian Child Welfare Act. We continue that today. We have a new genealogy section on the Facebook and people coming home. But we're limited by a government, one-fourth Indian, which is based on research, three-fourths French and one-quarter Indian is the perfect Indian. So you're qualified for Indian Health Service under that. Not our definition, not our rule. We are not cleansing agents. Today we are embracing peoples, indigenous peoples from all over. Humanity is the key today. So we will defend everyone based on community-based. We said that from day one. You have to know who your mother, your grandmother is, and it may be bilineal. You may be 10 generations removed, but everyone who came to Ochete were defining their in-the-closet Indian. They had to be. We were persecuted. The retribution was great. So we are community-based, based on our cultural values, based on our belief systems. Many of us, some of the Lakota tribes adopt white people, enroll white people. So there's a large, large field of how we do it. But if it's community-based and we say it's okay, I speak as a matriarch who we have now made CDs from our belief systems. And we have 400 people lined up at the university in Switzerland who want to pay big money to see this information. And we're like, sorry, we're going out to our communities to teach it to our children and our grandchildren first. We have seven sacraments. We have unwritten law, traditional law, customary box of law that no one knows, and yet to meet and match the threshold of understanding and mutual respect and mutual identity. We have Vietnamese Lakota. Every nation we have a prince in Kuwait whose mother's from here. So Lakotas, we missionized like everyone else. We went all over the world. We're Star Nation. Star Nation comes from a direct relationship with Tonkashula. So if we feel that the cultural, the religious, the spiritual mandates, we will do it. We will embrace humanity, and we will accept our relatives from all indigenous people. So thank you for hearing me.
Good to hear your voice. Wishing you well there in your community. And if you want to join us too, 1-800-996-2848. Also here too at Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada is Dr. Kim Talbert. She is a Canada Research Chair in Indigenous Peoples, Technoscience and Environment, and an Associate Professor at the University of Alberta. She is Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate. Our pleasure to have her here. Dr. Talbert, thank you for joining us for another Native America Calling. And I know you go by Kim. And so, Kim, I'll just given everything we heard from Phyllis, too, you know, my curiosity to you is whose definition matters when it comes to Native identity?
Hi, Tara. Well, I mean, ideally, it's our definitions, but we live in at a big power disadvantage with settler colonial states, right? The U.S. and Canada, I think, in particular, we'll talk about on this call. So, I think tribes, First Nations, other Indigenous communities are working hard to maneuver within that colonial structure. But, you know, the settler states hold the purse strings, right? We are forced to adjudicate our disputes in their courts of law. We work hard to push back against that. So, I mean, I think in practical terms, we're always attempting to assert not only our own laws, but our fundamental concepts about what it is to belong to our communities. And we're really overpowered, I think, and that's really what's at the heart of a lot of these disputes around quote-unquote pretendianism. So,
And Kim, what are the effects when there is falsified identity? Things you've witnessed, or maybe even things you know about that have affected Native nations? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can talk in both practical terms, and then we can talk in more ideological terms. And, you know, I'm not somebody who's investigated the practical, the pragmatic kind of resource-based implications of fraudulent claims. I think I heard Jackie Keeler talking on another podcast about actually investigating economic benefits to people who play Indian. There was also that LA Times series of articles that came out last year, I think, that was looking at fake Native claimants getting small business contracts. So I do think it's important to start calculating actually the resources that are extracted from potential Indigenous people by these kinds of frauds. That's not the kind of work I do. I think more about the sort of ideological or conceptual implications. So I do think there is harm done to the complexities that we're dealing with in Indian country around, say, citizenship and membership. And, you know, we all have stories, right? Those of us who come from Indigenous communities, be they reservation or urban, but who are from an actual living community, we all have stories about family members who can't get on the rolls. I mean, three of my mom's six grandchildren aren't enrolled, right? But they're raised, even though they're raised by Native women, you know, in extended Native family, we all have these stories. I think it does harm to us being able to work that stuff out when we are also having to deal with other people conflating, say, a Michelle Latimer story or an Elizabeth Warren or a Joseph Boyden story, people that have alleged very distant ancestry, often to people that cannot be named or communities that cannot be named. When those stories get conflated with the stories of our children and grandchildren, of those who were scooped, forcibly out adopted, you know, Native children who were removed, say, during, you know, the mid-20th century from Indigenous families, because of the kind of stuff Phyllis was talking about, right? The sort of making Indigenous people less than human, demonizing us, you know, denigrating us and our family systems because we were living in poverty, taking children. So I really want people to not confuse the real work that we are doing within our communities to figure out how to push back against colonial criteria of belonging with these other kinds of stories. These are not at all the same situation. And what I see out in Indian country is too many people conflating these situations, and they're not the same. And I think that also goes back to, I think what I heard Jacqueline Keeler saying on that other podcast is that we, if there's so much fraud going on, what's happening, and particularly in academia, and that's where I'm coming from, they are setting the terms of the conversation that we can have. So people who are absolutely disconnected, not just in their own lives, but since the 17th century or the 18th century, their families have lived as white. If we are allowing people like that to set the terms of this conversation and to theorize what Indigenous identity is, we're going to lose out to their definitions because the settler state has been trying to eliminate us either physically or conceptually since, you know, for hundreds of years. And so that's the situation that they were dealing with right now. And I think we have to be clear about the difference in these kinds of stories and claims.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And also on the line with us, too, is Jacqueline Keeler, who joins us out of Portland, Oregon. She's a writer and author of an upcoming book called Standing Rock, The Bundy Movement and the American Story of Occupation, Sovereignty, and the Fight for Sacred Lands. She is Dakota and Dene. Our pleasure to have her here on the line with us. Jacqueline, thank you for joining us for another Native America Calling. And as Kim introed some of your work and looking into claims of Indigenous identity, what led you down that path? And of course, if you have any initial comments, go for it.
Oh, sure. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on the show, Tara. It was actually the Michelle Latimer case and in Canada, the revealing of her fraud, and then also the more recently, the Claudia Lawrence case, where a woman who fraudulently claimed her late ex-husband's tribe, Hopi and Assiniboine, actually got published in the New York Times, doing the signature op-ed on the nomination of Deb Haaland. And you know, I spoke to her family and her in-laws, her Native in-laws, and I was quite alarmed. I think that this is just these claims unchecked are really eliminating us from the conversations that we can have about who we are and what our concerns are. And so we, and I know as a journalist over the years, I've had numerous Native folks bring this issue up to me. I'll be contacting a Native academic about something completely unrelated, and they'll say, you know, by the way, we're having this problem in our department, and they're getting ready to hire someone who is not Native at all, who's a fraud, to be my boss, right? And you know, they tried to alert them. And, of course, many of the people, so I created the alleged pretendians list based on this information and with many folks who do this research. And so many of these folks have already been outed over the years, but people have forgotten, or they that information is siloed in distinct communities, whether tribal communities or by field or era, you know, during a different time period. And so we don't know these things. And the folks on this list are not folks who have have any relationship whatsoever to any tribe. They are not members of state recognized tribes. They are we've looked at over 58 of them so far. Only two of them have, maybe three, have any ties whatsoever to any tribe. The rest that we've looked at, their family trees, have entirely white family trees. They are just white people, right? And we can tell this through a number of ways, through the documentation around their families. Their families are not undocumented. Their families are clearly documented. They are just not Native, right? And so
we got to go to break here. Because I want to know, when you get into this kind of research and you start realizing that their claim may be fraudulent, what then goes through your mind and how that affects maybe things that they have built up, maybe some of the credentials that they've had? We're going to get into more of this coming up after the break. This hour is definitely zipping by fast. So if you want to get in, you got to dial now, 1-800-996-2848.
If you're a Native American entrepreneur looking to expand or start up a business, you should know about the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program, a federal program encouraging private lenders to make the business loan you need. The Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can support you. Information available by emailing dci@bia.gov. That's dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program.
Thanks for tuning in to Native America Calling, and we are talking about Indigenous identity. What happens when somebody claims false Indigenous heritage? How does it affect you? How does it affect your tribal nation? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Right before the break, we heard from Jacqueline Keeler, a writer and author who is Dakota and Dene. Our pleasure to have her here. And Jacqueline, again, back to that point, when you're doing some of this research and things are pointing to that these claims may be false, what goes through your mind and how does that ultimately affect someone who's sitting there in their nation right now listening to this program?
Yeah, I think it has a huge effect that such a large percentage of people are willing to commit fraud. And even academics who should have a higher standard to their behavior. Everyone on this list is they're not private people. These aren't private sentiments they hold or believe. These are public people who work, who earn their living primarily as Native people with their Native identity, and if they don't make a lot of money off it, they are positioning themselves as our spokespeople on national or international issues, in which case there must be a higher sort of, a higher level that they have to meet of actually proving that they're Native to do so and have any connection to a tribe. It's quite, and these people have all made public comments, either to newspaper writer, author, they've published books, they've even done congressional testimony stating what they believe their tribal identity to be. So we have it on the record already going into it. And once we discover, we put together their family trees, we examine their claims, and we come to the determination that they are not Native, then we will see comment from them, and then we will also see comment from their employers and other folks. And then we will actually calculate, as Kim mentioned, begin to try to calculate the financial impact. And this financial impact can be quite extensive. The amount taken by fake Cherokee tribes documented by the LA Times a couple of years ago was, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, they, of course, the Indian Arts and Crafts Act actually, you know, there was a case in 2015, I think, where there was a huge bust of fake Navajo and Zuni jewelry that was being sold, commissioned and sold by Palestinian gallery owners and made in the Philippines. And the value of that was $35 million in Navajo and Zuni jewelry. And that is has a huge impact on our communities because the Navajo Nation, fully 30% of the families living on the Navajo Nation rely on arts and crafts like that for their income. So when you take $35 million from some of the poorest people in the country, I mean, Native people are constantly at, you know, the poorest per capita of any community, it really does constitute a taking. And even these professor professorships, you know, you're talking about six-figure salaries. You know, one of the guys we looked at, you know, he's making over $200,000 a year. That doesn't include lecture fees and books. And we looked at his family tree, and he is not Native. I mean, so we, you know, the previous generation fought for Native studies in the 70s. We wanted these departments, but what we're seeing is that these departments are being run by fraud, and that it constitutes a taking.
And Jacqueline, so what I'm also hearing from you is taking the space that maybe could be taken by somebody who has strong ties to their community. And I'm wondering what our listeners think of all of this. Join us. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. My phone lines are totally lighting up. Do want to bring in some callers. We're going to say now hello to Anne, who is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, tuned in online. Anne, thank you for giving us a ring. You're on air. Anne in Philadelphia, are you there? Okay, we now go to April, who is in San Francisco, tuned in online in California. April, thank you for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Good morning, everyone. My name is April, and I just wanted to say thank you to Phyllis for sharing all her knowledge. I think for one of the concerns that I have is when you're in an urban community and thinking about you know, defining what is Indian from our community and those that live among us, like Phyllis was referring to. And I think it's important that you know your story, you know your ancestral lineage, you know where you come from. And if you don't know that, then be honest about it and share that you don't know that. Because I think that that's where it becomes complicated, where people will associate, where they'll consider themselves Native by association. And I think it's important that as Native communities that we are allowed to ask who your family is, because I know that when we start to ask those questions, then it becomes, you know, it becomes lateral oppression. It becomes we're gaslighting somebody. But it's really a traditional teaching. And I think that, you know, what happens often, too, is that people will pick and choose who they want to call out as being Native, which then again becomes complicated. So when we think of this list and outing people and reminding people of who, say, has, you know, their story is complicated, I understand that. But when you create this list, then it becomes really even more confusing, and then it also becomes violent. And so I think that it can't have one person defining who is Native, one person defining who isn't. And it really comes back to your own story and who you are. As a California Indian person, I'm enrolled in my mother's tribe, Mamuki, Wailaki, Little Lake, and on my father, I'm Mishua Wapo, and I'm not enrolled on my father's side. They don't have federal recognition. And there's many people like that in California. I also see people attaching to the story of missing and murdered Indigenous women and taking their story and attaching it to that and saying that, you know, their ancestors were trafficked, and yet they don't know their ancestors' names. They don't know who they are or can connect them. So then you question, well, how do you know that story? And so we see this happen so much in California. And I know it's happening throughout Indian country, but it's really hard when you're in an urban community because you see so many people who are finding their identity or may have that ancestry. But be honest about it. Like, share that you may have just discovered that you were or found out you were. And because you do have that right to claim that, we don't have the right to say whether you do, but I think it comes back to just being honest and really sharing who you really are, but also making sure that we are not defining who that is.
Sure. And I think the other point, too, that you brought up in urban settings, too, and a lot of times in those urban settings, there is not a lot of knowledge of who Native people are and about the heritage. And sometimes it's easy to hide in plain sight. Very interesting. Thank you for your call there out of San Francisco, April. Also got on the line, Catherine in St. Louis, Missouri, tuned in online. Catherine, thanks for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Hi, I'm Poyum Da. Glad to be here. My name is Kathy Dickerson. I'm Kiowa tribe, and I live in an urban area, St. Louis, Missouri. And I've been working a lot with non-natives claiming to be Indian. First off, I want to say I believe if you have heritage, American Indian heritage, whatever it is, whatever tribe it is, celebrate it. It's when you cross that line of making a profit off the American Indian culture. So we don't claim the tribe. The tribe claims us as citizens. So when I'm an artist for the tribe, so I'm connected with the American Indian Arts and Crafts Board. I call there because I'm in an urban area. We have a lot of people claiming arts and crafts. And our arts and crafts law in D.C. is for intellectual property. It is not for visual performing arts. We have a big problem, and David Cornsilk said this a while back in 2006. There was list before, and it was called the Wall of Shame, and the American Indian Heritage Society was putting this out, and they had lawyers because some of these people get really radical. They start taking you to court, which I've been served three times, been to court twice, and had to prove that this person was not Indian, yet she's making money. So it was up to me to educate an urban lawyer so this person would not, take our culture. And I call that cultural genocide when these people do this because they're taking our culture and bastardizing it. So Missouri, what we did was a representative, House Representative Rocky Miller, CNO, tribal citizen, came up with a bill for the arts and crafts for Missouri, and we added in, and I testified for it, and we added in visual performing arts along with everything else, the intellectual property plus performing arts. That means, storytelling, plays, film, flute players, media, authors, because this is what's needed, is needed to protect our culture from becoming non-existent.
Catherine, wow, seems like we need to spend a lot more time talking about this. I got to move on, but thank you for giving us a ring there out of St. Louis, Missouri. One more call. We got Renee Everett, or Renee, out of Washington, tuned in online.
First of all, I want to express my condolences. I know Harlan passed last year of COVID. I want to acknowledge all those tribal members we've lost to that horrible pandemic. So my concern, the reason I'm calling is because I have seen this list and I personally know people on this list. And the list was gathered to my knowledge without all the facts being determined first. So some of the people that I know on this list are now facing backlash without verification and without any arbitration for this whole process. Are we creating a new McCarthy blacklist? Are we going to call it the red list? What are we doing to protect people's reputation after this is over with, who may well not belong on this list. And I'm not saying this isn't an important thing to do, because it totally is. I work in academia. I am a former journalist for Indian Country Today. My name is Renee Romanose, and I am more than willing to put my name out there, and along with my statement of, we should be careful how we're doing this, because we don't want to hurt innocent people along with guilty people. I really think that what is being done is important, as we've seen from what's happened in Canada with the director up there, with people claiming Native heritage without actually having it. We've seen it time and time again. I've seen it myself in academia. But let's not tar everyone with the same brush. Let's make sure we have our facts first before we go after people's reputations, people's lives, people's careers. Thank you.
All right, Renee, thank you for giving us a ring. And it was not determined that Harlan passed from COVID, but we do appreciate your condolences. And I guess I got to take that back to Dr. Andrew Jolivet, who also paid tribute to the individual at the beginning of the hour. And we know that, you know, this COVID has really affected our communities in very harsh ways. And of course, our thoughts continue to go out. And thank you all for the recognition that you continue to bring. Jacqueline, I got to bring in one more guest here, but I know people are making reference to the list. Just want to give you a quick moment. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I think I hear that, but these names have been brought forward for various reasons. We are looking and investigating them. It does say it clearly on the list that anyone who is an alleged pretendians list, I should say, and anyone that we vindicate, we will gladly share that information and give them all the information they need. We're working with one elder who has not been able to trace his family tree. He's given us all the information he has. We're working with him and the tribal historian from the Tribe Claims and other researchers. And if we are successful at doing this, you know, he may be able to use this in all kinds of ways, you know, for tribal recognition, for all kinds of things. And so it is actually also helpful to folks. And we will gladly, broadcast that and help them speak back to their detractors. So it is not, but right now, so far, with the 58 ongoing cases we're looking at, only two have any connection. And that is, if that trend holds, right, that is a very disturbing trend. And we are looking at trends and bias. You know, is there bias in hiring in favor of fraud? And so, yeah, I think, this could be helpful to some folks, and we are happy to do that. The issue is that these are people who are, no one on this list is a private person. We don't have, someone can privately hold ideas and thoughts. That's not our issue. People who have built their careers on their claims, there is a higher standard they have to meet. And they also have to actually have, I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation. My father is a citizen of the Yankton Sioux Tribe. All my grandparents are tribally rolled. But, if I were to go to speak, on behalf of Native people on issue, I feel like I would have to explain what my right is. And I think the fundamental one is that you have any ties at all to a tribe. The folks that we are not finding ties to, they literally have no Native ancestry, like none at all. We build their family trees back, all the way back to their immigrant ancestors. We build them sideways to look for any cousins or second cousins twice removed who might be enrolled. Literally, these are people from entirely white families. Okay, entirely, like not even, there's no hidden Indian. And even if there was, what would that mean compared to the rest of their colonial family? We're talking family trees with thousands of people in them, right? And so that one ancestor you find way back there, what does that even mean? So it's so these are people who have put themselves out there, have built a career, sometimes for decades, on these claims. And so, yes, there is a higher standard for them to meet.
Well, I don't think we should sign off air, but there is no time left for us to continue to air the program, because we are in a really great discussion and looks like we'll need to spend more time talking about this in the future. And you had a moment, an hour to be with us to think about this. And what are your thoughts? Reach out. We're still curious. You can find us comments at NativeAmericaCalling.com. And thank you to everybody that we heard from today, Jacqueline Keeler, Dr. Kim Tallbear, Dr. Andrew Jolivet, as well as all of our callers and Dr. Kim Tallbear. I'm Tara Gatewood. We'll meet you here tomorrow.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Centers for Medicare to Medicaid Hachipkan.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.